A complex system of subway cars carried the responsibility of receiving and transporting all money from subway stations throughout the city of New York and surrounding boroughs. All money was transferred to a so-called money room, the most secure room in the state, until 1979. In what has been described as the perfect crime, an unknown number of individuals managed to walk away from the secured second floor of the Transit Authority's J Street building in Brooklyn with $600,000 in cash undetected. Despite extensive investigations combined between the Transit Police, New York Police, and FBI, the individuals responsible managed to elude them all. Who was responsible for the flawlessly executed heist showing no force and causing no damage? Was it an inside job? And if so, how did the thief or thieves manage to escape with all of that money never being caught? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 116, The New York Transit Authority Heist. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we're examining an unsolved heist from New York in 1979. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information to submit a case suggestion, or you can do so directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. I know a heist case is somewhat out of my wheelhouse, but considering what's been going on this past week, I thought for this week, we might all need a break from a normal episode filled with horror and grief, pain and madness. An unsolved heist to provide all of the intrigue and none of the despair. Also, please stick around at the end of the episode today for a special message. For now, this is episode 116, The New York Transit Authority Heist. Today, the northwest corner of J Street and Willoughby Street in Brooklyn goes mostly unnoticed. At 370, there's a 13-story white limestone building which draws little attention, if any. In a city flush with iconic buildings and structures, it's unlikely anyone has ever gone out of their way to take a look at the dulling edifice of the boxy building. However, in 1979, the building was bustling with more than 2,500 employees working for the New York City Transit Authority and Metropolitan Transit Authority, which dealt with all forms of public transportation in the city. The building had been strategically located over already existing subway tunnels. Over the years, the Transit Authority began moving operations out of the building, relocating them to different locations to better facilitate their operations. It wasn't until 2006, though, when the money trains operation ended, and the building was largely abandoned by the Transit Authority. You see, back before the overwhelming use of Metro cards and card-based purchases, the New York subway system used a token system. Essentially, you could go to token machines, purchase a certain amount and value of tokens, and then these would operate the turnstiles which allow entrance to the subway platforms. Today, you just slide a Metro card and walk down the stairs. The tokens became active for use just 2 years after the construction of the building at 370 J Street and were phased out in 2003. In order to process all of the funds that would come in, the Transit Authority needed a secure system with which they could move the funds. Surely, they could have employed armored cars, but this wouldn't have been the safest nor the most efficient method. Armored cars would have to roll through the streets of New York and park at subway entrances, while armed guards would have to descend down into the subways, open the machines, unload the funds, pack them in a bag, which would include change that's heavy, and then make the trek back to the vehicle. This would expose the officers, as well as the inner operations of the machines and, of course, the money, to anyone in the area which the transit authority believed could lead to trouble. Aside from the security risk, there is, of course, the ever-jammed traffic of Manhattan and the fact that there are 472 subway stations operating in New York, making it the largest rapid transfer system in the world by sheer number of stops. They aren't just in Manhattan either, with the subway servicing the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Queens. Today's numbers show that more than 4.3 million people ride the New York subways every day, that being about 50% of the total population of New York City. Using the same numbers, approximately 50%, that would mean that in 1979, around 3.4 million riders. As you can imagine, this would result in a lot of loose cash and change being in those machines. In the face of these challenges, a new system was developed and would be commonly referred to as the money trains. The system officially began at the turn of the 20th century and obviously grew extensively over the years. Old subway cars, which had been retired from service, underwent an overhaul. The cars were extensively cleaned and repainted, solid yellow cars with black angled stripes. A money train consisted of two cars, one for holding the money, the other for holding a collection of agents. According to UntappedCities.com, the money trains operated simultaneously, six nights a week, making collections from 25 to 40 stations per train each night. All collection agents were specially trained, armed, and dressed in pocketless uniforms which included body armor. Over the years, more train cars would be added as the operation expanded, as in 1988, an additional 10 sets of cars were added in. Later, as technology advanced, a new item would be added to the uniforms, a transponder, which allowed supervisors to know the position of every agent working the cars at any time. The transponders served double duty, also operating as personal alarms, which would send a signal directly to the main command center in case of an emergency. At the end of their runs, the money trains would file into the station beneath J Street, where the money would be removed from the trains and transferred through a hallway at the rail level, a small platform there for agents to step right off the train into the tunnel. Through the tunnel, concrete with no decoration outside of dim orange lights every 10 to 15 feet, which was closed off by a gate on either end, and agents would walk along a set of concrete steps built over a large network of pipes, rolling the money along in carts. But the trip would be short. Agents would have to carry the heavy bags, climb four sets of stairs just to reach the ground level of the building, where they would once again utilize carts, then ride elevators to the second floor and deposit funds into what was dubbed the money room. Inside the room were numerous desks for counting, breaking the money down by denomination, and calculators for adding up totals before money was banded, again by denomination, into bricks, which would then be transported into the cages of a secured vault. The vault itself was secured by thick iron bars protecting the money. However, on weekends, the money was often instead kept in safes inside the vault. The combination lock codes were separated, each agent's supervisor with authorization to open the safes, 10 in total, had only half the required numbers, meaning that they couldn't be opened without at least two supervisors present. In 1979, the 10 supervisors with the combination had all been working for the Transit Authority for over 15 years. The money would be held there until it could be transported to the Federal Reserve Bank in Manhattan. Entry to the money room itself was also secure, requiring someone on the inside to buzz agents in. Without someone on the inside, entry to the room would be impossible short of busting through a wall or breaking down the heavy, secured door. There was no system to open the door from the outside in hopes of halting any attempted robberies. If you're outside and no one presses the buzzer, you're simply not getting in. This means that at least one agent had to be inside of that room 24 hours a day. According to the New York Daily News, there were other levels of security. A police officer would be posted in the main room and have access to a security camera, which would give him a view into the cage area, while another cop would be present. The security system also gave the officer views of the two main freight elevators, the tunnel, and the rail area itself. There were also 24 different security sensors monitoring the rooms, which would send emergency signals to the control room on the same floor, and local police in the event of a robbery or emergency situation. The money room was referred to as a man trap in jest by those working for the transit authority. However, this so-called impenetrable room had a fatal flaw, which was actually discovered by two transit agents just months prior to the robbery. On May 20th, at 11 p.m., two agents made a shockingly stupid decision. They exited the secure room together, leaving no one behind to operate the buzzer. Now, there have been multiple explanations of how and why this happened, though I've never seen one that was actually confirmed by the transit authority. One, which I found amusing, suggested that the two guards, seriously craving a cup of coffee, stepped out together and didn't realize their mistake until they returned. I've seen others that suggested the mistake was recognized instantaneously. Have you ever locked yourself out of your house or out of your car? Typically, within seconds of locking that door, you get hit with that rush of, oh no, my keys are in there. I could see that happening here, and while not a supremely humorous situation, I would have loved to have seen the looks on their faces when they realized their mistake. Now, you'd imagine that after they had their oh shit moment, the two had competing thought processes. Either we've got to call our boss and tell him what happened, or we've got to figure out how to get back into that room and maybe we won't lose our jobs. As you might expect, these two went with the second option, and much to their surprise, after an undetermined amount of time running through all the options, they actually managed to figure it out. The second floor of the building was laid out in such a way that there were multiple rooms besides just the money room and counting rooms. Imagine looking at a blueprint of a building, a large square divided by five horizontal lines. Starting at the bottom, you had two freight elevators facing one another in a main corridor, which also held the door to the office of Sandy Garalick, the Transit Authority Police Chief. Walking past that door from right to left, you'd make a slight right turn into a lobby area which housed a police desk for verifying identity. Access to this floor was restricted to Transit Authority agents and police only. In this lobby, there were three doors. One led into a men's locker room, another into a women's locker room, and then a third door which led into a secured checkpoint where agents had to enter before being buzzed into the counting room. The counting room has a door which grants access to the money room itself, which would be located at the top of the square on your blueprint. The women's locker room shared a wall with the money room itself beyond the buzz-in door. The two agents who managed to lock themselves out went into that women's locker room where they examined the walls and found a loose plate. Prying the plate off, they exposed the soft material of the inner wall. Through what measures I can't say for sure, they managed to create a hole in that wall through which they climbed to find themselves back inside the money room. Crisis averted. Reports of the time seem to suggest that the hole may actually have already been present behind that plate. To their credit, the two agents not only told their supervisors what had happened, but they explained the flaw in the money room security. They were allowed to keep their jobs. A report was filed and passed up the chain of command for the transit authority. As you might have already assumed, despite this critical flaw, the procedure by which they repaired the hole was a rather lackluster one. A piece of plywood was placed over the 20 square inch hole. Yes, a room holding millions of dollars in transit funds was protected by a half-inch thick piece of plywood that you could punch a hole through with a hammer with little effort. Due to this, it became a joke amongst the agents in the money room, who referred to this area now as the soft wall. Just 2 months later, that soft wall would play a major role in the robbery. On Friday, July 20th, Money Room supervisors Benjamin Williams and John Kenny were overseeing operations. As money was sorted and banded together, they played a vital role in securing those funds. Working together, the two men began moving stacks of money banded together into large bricks into the safe. Having done this many times before, the two supervisors took note of the money in the safe before locking it up and spinning the dial, securing it for over that weekend, during which time no money trains would be operating due to plans for the next night. According to both Williams and Kenny, the money was there when they walked out at 6:05 p.m., exactly as they had secured it. On Saturday, July 21st, It was a hot night in New York, and things were only just heating up as the air conditioners stopped working. A drill was planned to take place at J Street that night, which would include the power to the building, including the money room, being shut off for approximately an hour. A message was broadcast via teletype, warning agents about the potential for a robbery situation, explaining that during the power outage, quote, "When the power is shut down, telephones will neither ring nor light up. The revenue alarm board located in the vicinity of the operations duty officer will totally light up. The alarm board cannot be reset until power is restored." End quote. Ultimately, the power was out for 55 minutes. In an extra step of security to ensure that the drill didn't result in anyone having any funny ideas, two money room supervisors, in addition to one police officer, were left behind to guard the money room. One would assume this would be enough to ensure the security of the room, but after that weekend, money room supervisors would be in for a major surprise. On Monday, July 23rd, supervisors Williams and Kenny returned to the money room to begin their week. After performing several administrative tasks, at approximately 9:25 a.m., the two worked in tandem to open the safe for transfer to the Federal Reserve Bank. As the heavy door pulled open, both men were shocked by what they saw. Where there had been a large stack of bricks of $10 bills, there was a large gap, approximately the size of an air conditioner, according to Williams. While at the moment an exact amount wasn't estimated, it was quite clear that it was a large sum of money and it was missing. Williams and Kenny immediately notified their supervisor, Sylvester DeBose, whose official title was Assistant Director of Revenue. DeBose immediately picked up the phone and called Chief Garlick, and according to the Daily News, directly stated, quote, "I want to report a crime," end quote. Garlick, in what I can only call a comical response, replied, quote, "Maybe the money has merely been misplaced," end quote. It takes Garlick a total of 4 hours until he decides this is worth reporting as a crime, which occurs at approximately 1:30 p.m. The Daily News, having learned about the theft apparently several hours before the NYPD was made aware, contacted Garlick's office and spoke with Ed Silberfarb, the spokesman for the Transit Authority. When asked about the theft, Silberfarb replied, quote, "What theft? This is the first I've heard of it," end quote. I don't know if that's what he sounded like or not, but that's what I heard it in my head sounding like. In total, $600,000 worth of $10 bricks was taken. In an interview with the Daily News, Andy Sparberg, an author and transit historian, explained, quote, "The money was in 60 bricks of 1,000 bills apiece, an estimated weight of 120 pounds, end quote. That's not a huge amount of weight, but that's not something easy to just swing around either. When Garlick himself was directly asked by reporter Richard Edmonds who could have pulled off the heist, his response was a confused one, with Garlick replying, quote, "Well, I don't want to say anything on the record on that, and I'd rather not make any comments off the record. Actually, I'm trying to keep a low profile on the whole thing," end quote. When asked about the hole, the one covered by the plywood, Garlick denied any knowledge of the hole itself, although reportedly his response was, "Oh God," which seems to suggest he might have known. Interestingly, there appears to be a paper trail to follow. According to reports, after the two guards informed their supervisor about the hole in the wall and the incident where they had locked themselves out, a report was filed and sent to a lieutenant, who then forwarded that message to his captain, John Doyle. Doyle then sent the message to Deputy Chief Anthony Bouza, who wrote at the top of the report, quote, "Please follow up relative to the integrity of the security of the revenue room," end quote. And then he sent the report to Deputy Inspector John Wilson, who would determine what action should be taken. All of this occurred in late May. At the time of the aforementioned interview with Garlick in August of 79, he explained, quote, "I don't think appropriate action was taken," end quote. Clearly not. Some at the time found it hard to believe that Garlick wasn't aware of the issue, since people on his own floor were joking about it in the weeks afterwards between May and July. Remaining in a state of denial, Garlick referred to the crime as a, quote, "alleged theft" at a press conference on Tuesday, July 24th. The thief or thieves seemed to know exactly what they were targeting, going for the $10 bills, and ignoring other readily available sums of money. The robbers left behind $1.1 million in different denominations, $2 million in change, and over $4 million in subway tokens. It was also reported at the time that the money stolen was insured against loss, hitting the transit authority with a $25,000 deductible, a paltry sum in comparison. To investigate the crime, they pulled out all the stops. 25 transit detectives worked with a 7-man special squad of elite detectives in conjunction with detectives from the NYPD and special agents from the FBI. Investigators were met with quite the challenge. First, they had to try and locate the money, but that would be nearly impossible. It was made up of $10 bills, which would be easily circulated, and it would be overwhelming to ask businesses to report people paying for items with $10 bills in large sums, but they tried anyway. While some police were trying to follow the trail of the money, rather fruitlessly, others were back at J Street, trying to figure out how exactly the money was removed in the first place. Initially, it was thought the theft had likely occurred during the planned power outage. However, some began to consider it may have occurred as early as Friday night, just hours after the money had been locked in the safe. When asked about the time frame of the power outage, some 55 minutes, Transit Authority Chief Detective Nick Cusia explained that it's as likely as any other time frame from Friday night to Monday morning. The only thing which was clear to investigators at the time was that someone on the inside had been involved in the heist, possibly more than one. The safe was open, so the combination was known. There were no signs of forced entry and no damage done to the building itself. Also, whoever had committed the crime knew about the soft wall entry point. It was speculated that the news about the power outage, released the Wednesday before the theft, may have given the thieves the green light. Police turned to their employees, fingerprinting and questioning 733 transit employees. DuBose told the Daily News, quote, "All porters, counters, stackers of money, anyone who had access to the revenue room is being fingerprinted and questioned," end quote. When asked about how long they thought it would take to weed out those responsible, Chief of Detectives Nick Cusia replied, quote, "This is not a piece of cake. This could take a while to solve," end quote. And a long time indeed it has taken, coming up on 41 years this July. The next step was to look at the 10 agents who had parts of the combination. One of them was away on vacation at the time, and his absence from New York was confirmed, so he was questioned and ruled out. The remaining 9, though, in addition to being fingerprinted and questioned, were also asked to take polygraph examinations, and they all agreed to do so. Interestingly, one of the 9 failed his polygraph. I've made my opinion on polygraphs quite clear. I don't put a lot of stock in them, and while this particular agent failed, there was no evidence against him. In this instance, though, the polygraph examination may have been more flawed, as these were not uniform tests. Each agent was not asked the same things, nor were they approached from the same angle. The tests included questions about their own specific backgrounds, questions provided to the examiner by Gerlich himself. In addition to the polygraphs, thorough checks were done of the agents' financial situations, bank accounts, home ownership, and other areas that might be important. Had they bought anything extravagant lately, etc. Now, I can't say if this is the same person or not as to the one who failed the polygraph, but there was a time when a man was listed as a suspect. He was questioned by authorities and then was handed over to the district attorney's office for questioning, but he refused to answer these additional questions and requested a lawyer. I should further note that reporting from the Daily News specifies that all money room employees still had their jobs the next year, which seems to suggest that even if the suspect was an employee, there wasn't enough information to relieve him of his duties, and a failed polygraph would never hold up in court, especially since they're inadmissible. There were 2 others who faced additional questions beyond the failed polygraph employee. 2 people who worked with him. One was a man and one was a woman, though their names have never been released. In total, the FBI later stated that they believe the team of thieves was comprised of 3 to 6 people, all of whom likely worked for the Transit Authority. Depending on the number, that's a split of between $100,000 and $200,000 apiece. Investigators also began to believe more firmly that the crime had actually taken place on Friday, going so far as to say it likely occurred before the vault itself was locked that night, but probably after the safe was locked. Feeling the heat from what was perceived as either his inability to act or his lack of knowledge about what was going on in his own money room, Gerlich fired back in the press. He claimed that 2 years earlier, in 1977, he had made a recommendation of sweeping changes to the security procedures and processes surrounding the money room itself. Part of that process would have added computer access card checkpoints, much like was used in high-level banks at the time. He had multiple recommendations based on a study performed by his office, which would have totaled approximately $250,000 in changes. Reportedly, the man in charge of that decision, Andrew O'Rourke, felt the changes would cost too much money, and he had great faith in the current system, believing that the changes would be unnecessary. To this date, there's been absolutely no progress on this case. The only solid evidence ever recovered happened shortly after the crime, with two empty money bags used by the Transit Authority being found in a motel room in New Jersey. There were really only two theories that developed out of it. One theory argued that the crime was committed, and then multiple people somehow managed to walk out of the building with over $600,000 in $10 bills without being noticed, or perhaps it was committed by a single person. Beyond that, it was also considered possible that the money itself may have been dropped out of a window to people waiting on the street, since it would have been difficult to walk past security with that sum of money. However, it may also depend on how many people were involved. If it were six, the highest estimate each person would only have to walk out with was 20 pounds of $10 bills. That would be 100 stacks of $10 bills apiece. If it was only three, the challenge would have been higher, but being that the hole in the money room was in a locker room, it was surmised that weekend employees could have stashed some of the money in a locker and then taken it out in smaller amounts over the weekend. Also, some of the money could have been tossed out the window just to make carrying the rest out even easier. There was, of course, the possibility of an inside job that wasn't wholly an inside job, at least not in the way investigators were looking at it. Surely, there was a cleaning crew. Someone had to put that plywood up. I imagine they were looked at closely. However, it seems also unlikely someone who had never been in there and didn't have the credentials to gain access to the money room could have been involved. It doesn't seem like an outside job in that sense. No forced entry, and it would be difficult for someone to gain the combination codes, let alone know the layout well enough. The case basically fell off the grid. No one was arrested, none of the money was found, no official suspect was ever named, and no charges were filed. Gerlich was fired a year later, along with Deputy Chief Buza, though their terminations were not about the heist, but more specifically a rise in crime on the subways. The money was recovered through insurance minus the deductible. The building on J Street continued to be the home of that money room for the Transit Authority for another 26 years before being mostly vacated by 2006. The money trains themselves stopped running that same year. With so much of the money being done through debit cards and credit cards versus cash, the MTA transitioned back to using armored cars. So things moved on. The money found its way back into circulation, and today, who knows where it might be. Whoever executed the theft performed what may be dubbed a perfect crime. No solid evidence left behind, no major developments outside of a suspect who, under pressure, never revealed anything, if he was even involved. There's that old saying, three people can keep a secret if two are dead. In this case, though, it seems most likely that at least three people, and possibly as many as six, have managed to keep this secret for over 40 years. The subways keep moving. The building on J Street is being converted into space for New York University's Center for Urban Science and Progress. The money trains are a thing of the past. The system has been modernized, and the memory of a flawless heist fades with most New Yorkers not even being aware of what happened right beneath their streets. I've always had an interest in heists, from the Antwerp jewel heist to the Lufthansa heist. I don't know why exactly. Well, maybe I should specify that I've always had an interest in heist movies. I think ultimately it's the planning that gets me, how much time and effort someone puts into thinking of every possibility. Now, I'm certainly not in favor of theft or any crime for that matter, but the psychology of someone who's going to plan and execute a heist is interesting to me. The non-violent ones, that is. I remember reading about the theft of the crown jewels, for instance, and it just fascinated me. I thought this would be a good week to focus on something that showed no violence, caused no major damage, gave no grief, and ultimately remains as unsolved, but mostly forgotten. One of, if not the most secure rooms in all of New York was breached. $600,000 in $10 bills was taken, and all these years later, there's still no answer about who did it. Sure, there's speculation. An employee, a group of employees, a combination of employees and regular citizens. Maybe it's because the money was insured, maybe it's because they couldn't figure it out so they didn't want to talk about it anymore, but somehow this all got lost to time, and today, as a former New Yorker, I only became aware of it a few months back. How's that possible? It's not on any list, by the way. I couldn't find a mention of it online outside of articles written by the Daily News and a blurb here or there when the Money Train program ended. So we don't have a ton to work with here. Based on everything I've read, if there were fingerprints found, they never matched anyone. I'd imagine the thieves would have worn gloves at a minimum. Somehow, they managed to get 120 pounds of $10 bills out of one of the most secure buildings without anyone noticing for between 48 and 62 hours. The way they breached security was one known by everyone on that floor. Everyone that worked the money room, except apparently the main guy in charge, which I find shockingly difficult to believe. It almost feels like one of those instances of ego. Even with the hole in the wall of the building was so secure no one could possibly get away with a heist. Well, I guess they did. Most investigators believe that the crime took place on Friday, the night before the planned drill. That would make sense. Pull the money, get away, and leave the whole weekend open before anyone's even going to notice the money is gone. Now, if you're going to run, that makes sense. Give yourself a nice lead over investigators. By the time they know the money's gone, you're thousands of miles away. But if this was an inside job, then some of the people who participated in the crime walked back into that building and worked their normal shifts after that weekend, and that's pretty brazen. That weekend was just the perfect combination of factors. The hole in the wall was there and well known, the power outage was coming and would disable the alarms, no one would be opening the safes until Monday. Factors like this make it hard for me to believe there wasn't at least one person on the inside. A lot of people believe it had to be two. Remember, each agent supervisor only had half the combination to the safes. But how hard is it to peek over someone's shoulder and get their half of it? Some people can't help but look out of the corner of their eye to see who you're texting, and they're certainly not going to get any money out of that. So, you've really got three main possibilities. Complete inside job with all people involved having worked that money room. Partial inside job with some who worked the room and some who didn't. Or complete outside job with the hit being conducted by someone who either didn't work there or didn't work there anymore. So, let's start at the bottom and work our way to the top. Who knows what people talk about when they're discussing their jobs? Some people will tell close friends vital details of their job that they're not supposed to tell anyone. It's not impossible to imagine that someone could have mentioned to a friend that they have this super secure room, but someone crawled through a hole in the wall and no one fixed it. Now, maybe that friend tells a friend who tells another friend. You know how it works. So sure, people outside of the transit authority could have been aware of that security flaw, but it still doesn't answer the question of how they got in the building. Maybe you could disguise yourself as a member of the cleaning crew, or someone else who can get access to the second floor, but I'd imagine there's some kind of check for that. You'd presume that someone working the desk would be made aware of someone new being added to the cleaning crew, and the transit authority likely utilized its own employees in terms of cleaning anyway. So, that might be a bit difficult to execute. However, I can't think of a way to get into that building without passing through the security checkpoints. They found no sign of forced entry, no doors pried, no vent covers removed, nothing. So how do you get in? It seems startlingly unlikely someone could have pulled this heist off without someone on the inside. Obviously, the cameras in that room were live and not recording, otherwise they'd have gotten footage of whoever had taken the money, so it was likely someone who knew that the cameras operated in that way. This, of course, is assuming that the crime actually happened on Friday and not Saturday when the power was out. It seems most likely Friday was the day of the crime. They had heightened security on Saturday, which would have made it even more difficult. everyone who worked that money room was made aware of the planned drill and outage. Everyone knew that come Saturday, that building was going to have increased security but no alarm system. So, maybe it could have been someone who was brought in to be part of that increased security. Someone who knew they would be in that vault and no one else would be in there with them. That kind of doesn't make sense, though, considering the other police officer would be watching the cameras to see into the vault room. Maybe he was in on it, too. Hard to say without knowing where the camera was looking, though. Did it cover the whole room, or was it just watching the door, or just watching the vault? I don't know. Two supervisors locked the money in the safe Friday night. Later, the vault was locked. We only have their word to go on about how much money was in the safe and how much was missing. They have sworn that they walked out of the building when the safe was full. I imagine they were questioned thoroughly about that night, but it does seem irrational, to a degree, for the thieves to put themselves in a situation where they are the last ones to handle that money. Then again, someone failed to polygraph, and whether or not that matters, I don't really know, but we have no idea who that person actually was outside of it being someone who worked there and had half a combination. So it would surely make sense if the crime involved at least some people, or even just one, working on the inside. Someone who knew the full extent of the security measures, someone who knew the drill would be executed that weekend, someone who knew that hole was in the wall and was clearly reachable by anyone who could get into the women's locker room, which, despite having the pass by the main security desk, had no additional security on it. The hole in the wall is the key here. Everyone who knew about that hole was a suspect, and unfortunately, almost everyone who worked there knew about it. Well, apparently, except for the guy running the place. It does make you wonder if it was just a coincidental combination of events happening. Two guys discover the hole because they locked themselves out. 2 months later, there's going to be a long weekend where the security system's going to be disabled for a while. Maybe it all just falls together. Maybe a few agents start talking about it. Maybe they're disgruntled. Maybe they're frustrated that they're making a basic salary while the guy in charge of the floor is pulling in $80,000 a year for just hanging out in an office for the most part. Who knows the logic behind it? When I used to work with money, I had a head of security that I had to deal with. We had extensive measures to protect that money. Surveillance system, alarms, coded entry, changing combinations. The system was completely covered, and yet people still tried to get away with stealing money. I never saw a single person successfully do it. They were all caught. How they thought they wouldn't get caught, I don't know. However, something has always stuck with me that the security head told me. Never put a good person in a situation to make a bad decision. Money can be tempting, and any person in a position of authority over that money at some point has fantasized about taking it. You've got to be paying attention to states of mind. There's a lot more to security than just technology. There's psychology. Someone starts acting strange, someone appears disgruntled, whatever. You pull them from having access until the issue is settled or things return to normal. You talk to them. Once people start down the path of fantasy, start paying attention to all the angles, it's just a matter of time before someone tries something because they think they can get away with it. Obviously, this doesn't apply to all people, but it certainly applies to some. Anyway, before I go off on a whole tangent about that, I think it's important to realize that over time, people become upset with their positions, people have things at their job that annoy them, some people believe something is owed to them. I've certainly seen people caught trying to rob a safe claiming that they didn't get this or they didn't get that, so they felt they deserved it. Who's to say that didn't happen here? You work with these people almost every day, you chat while you're riding the trains, carrying the money, sorting it, counting it, securing it. You talk about your grievances, maybe you find common ground. Maybe it starts in the wind like a joke. Ha ha, I bet we could get away with this or that. It's just playing around. But the conversation happens more. The joke starts to get serious and something happens to turn on the light bulb and an idea emerges. Maybe someone jokes, hey, that hole in the wall would make things easy. This isn't something you bring to someone directly, though, if you're not sure of their allegiances. You bring it to them in jest, in a way that it's a form of grooming. You figure out where they stand, you bring them into the joke, and over time, maybe the joke becomes serious for them. One thing, though, above all else, the group must be secret, they must be trusted, there must be some kind of an alliance that is understood. One goes down, you all go down, so you better keep your mouth shut. And that happened. Whoever executed this heist kept their mouths shut. No one has ever figured out who it was. No one has ever been caught trying to buy a Cadillac in all $10 bills. Nobody made huge deposits into their bank accounts. I assume their homes and apartments were searched and no one was found sleeping on a mattress filled with $10 bills. Who better to perform this heist than the people on the inside? Who better than those who know every in and out, those who know about the hole, those who know exactly what money is where and how to take it? It was disciplined. They didn't take millions. They didn't get greedy and try to walk out with more than they could successfully pass through the building, the window, or both. I find it very difficult to believe this wasn't planned out, probably over the course of a month or more. This wasn't an off-the-cuff robbery. This was strategic and executed flawlessly. So, full inside job, 3 to 6 people, 1 or 2 working the money, 1 or 2 committing to getting the money out of the building, 1 or 2 working as spotters or distractions. Makes sense to me. A female employee was questioned thoroughly about possibly being involved. Might make sense. Who else could get into the women's locker room without drawing attention to themselves? Agents and employees wore uniforms without pockets, but there are locker rooms, which seems to suggest to me that they arrived in their street clothes and changed. How many of them had street clothes without pockets? How many of them didn't bring a bag or something to carry lunch or clothes? To me, this was an inside job. This was a group of people who knew what they were doing and knew how to get away with it. People who wouldn't fold under questioning. People who wouldn't be worried about a polygraph test. Hell, one person failed, but who knows what question he failed on? Was it about the heist or about his personal background? Again, we have no way to know, and polygraphs, while often utilized in situations like this, aren't exactly trustworthy, let alone 1979 polygraphs. This guy failed, and yet they still couldn't find any evidence to pin the crime on him. Imagine these people, or maybe this one person who worked there pulling off this heist, possibly with assistance, and walking right back into work for their next shift acting like they had no idea what happened. This wasn't done in a sloppy way, which to me suggests the certainty of inside knowledge. Imagine the discipline to walk out with $600,000 and to never give off even the slightest hint that you have it. No major purchases, nothing to give it all away. Maybe you find a way to launder that money, it's a possibility. A crime like that in New York in the late 70s? Wouldn't be surprised if the mafia was utilized to assist in the process or used pressure to get one of the employees to do the job for them. It's not like a debt to a loan shark is going to show up in financial background checks. There is the extremely slim possibility that this was a completely outside job. You can't rule it out. Hell, transit police said they couldn't rule out any potential suspects. The only thing we really know for sure is that over 41 years, they've never slipped up. If they did work there, then they finished out their jobs and retired or moved on elsewhere without suspicion. They obviously never did it again. There wasn't another robbery. This was a one-time deal. By now, the statute of limitations on the robbery has run out, and yet still, not a word about it. I would say, unless someone makes a deathbed confession, or someone just outright admits to it, or a ton of $10 bills are found, though it's highly unlikely that the money hasn't already been used, this case will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. Next time you've got an old $10 bill in your hand, just think, it could have been one of those. If you're looking for more information about the New York Transit Authority robbery, there's not a lot of information on it out there. However, the Daily News in 1979 and 1980 did a really great series of articles about it, and this episode would not have been possible without those articles. If you have any information about the New York Transit Authority robbery, please contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-577-TIPS. That's T-I-P-S. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, send an email to TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. I'm about to thank our amazing Patreon producers, but before I do that, I just want to give you a reminder to stick around at the end of the episode for a special segment. Special thank you to Patreon producers Alicia Lorraine, Astrid Maria Nyer, Brett Eady, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Jessica Chagnon, Jessica Yount, Kevin Bonham, Lee Campbell, Megan Cotter, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Samantha Ford, Stephanie Eve, Stephen Weiland, Tara Doble, Tom Archer, Tracy Woods, and Travis Skepko. You're all amazing, and I am incredibly grateful for your generosity and support for Trace Evidence. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I know it's a bit out of the ordinary, but we're not living in ordinary times. I don't feel it's my place to give my opinions on anything of such a vital and important nature as to what is currently happening here and around the world. However, I did want to leave this episode tonight with words spoken more than 52 years ago, and in my opinion, still poignantly relevant today. On April 5th, 1968, the day after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy made the following address to the City Club of Cleveland. 2 months later, Bobby himself would die from an assassin's bullet.
It is not a day for politics. I have saved this one opportunity, my only event of today, to speak briefly to you about the mindless menace of violence in America, which again stains our land and every one of our lives. It is not the concern of any one race. The victims of the violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. They are most important of all, human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed. And yet it goes on and on and on in this country of ours. Why? What has violence ever accomplished? What has it ever created? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet. No wrongs have ever been righted by riots and civil disorders. A sniper is only a coward, not a hero. And an uncontrolled or uncontrollable mob is only the voice of madness, not the voice of the people. Whenever any American's life is taken by another American unnecessarily, whether it is done in the name of the law or in defiance of the law, by one man or by a gang, in cold blood or in passion, in an attack of violence or in response to violence, whenever we tear at the fabric of our lives, which another man has painfully and clumsily woven for himself and his children, whenever we do this, then the whole nation is degraded. Among free men, said Abraham Lincoln, there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet. And those who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. Yet we seemingly tolerate a rising level of violence that ignores our common humanity and our claims to civilization alike. We calmly accept newspaper reports of civilian slaughter in far-off lands. We glorify killing on movie and television screens, and we call it entertainment. We'd make it easier for men of all shades of sanity to acquire weapons and ammunition that they desire. Too often we honor swagger and bluster and the wielders of force. Too often we excuse those who are willing to build their own lives on the shattered dreams of other human beings. Some Americans who preach nonviolence abroad fail to practice it here at home. Some accuse others of rioting and inciting riots, have by their own conduct invited them. Some look for scapegoats, others look for conspiracies. But this much is clear: violence breeds violence, repression breeds retaliation, and only a cleansing of our whole society can remove this sickness from our souls. For there is another kind of violence, slower, but just as deadly destructive as the shot or the bomb in the night. This is the violence of institutions, indifference, inaction, and decay. This is the violence that afflicts the poor, that poisons relations between men because their skin has different colors. This is the slow destruction of a child by hunger and schools without books and homes without heat in the winter. This is the breaking of a man's spirit by denying him the chance to stand as a father and as a man amongst other men. And this too afflicts us all. For when you teach a man to hate and to fear his brother, when you teach that he is a lesser man because of his color or his beliefs or the policies that he pursues, when you teach that those who differ from you threaten your freedom or your job or your home or your family, then you also learn to confront others, not as fellow citizens, but as enemies, to be met not with cooperation, but with conquest, to be subjugated and to be mastered. We learn at the last to look at our brothers as alien men with whom we share a city, but not a community. Men bound to us in common dwelling, but not in a common effort. We learn to share only a common fear, only a common desire to retreat from each other, only a common impulse to meet disagreement with force. For all this, there are no final answers for those of us who are American citizens. Yet we know what we must do, and that is to achieve true justice among all of our fellow citizens. The question is not what programs we should seek to enact. The question is whether we can find in our own midst and in our own hearts that leadership of humane purpose that will recognize the terrible truths of our existence. We must admit the vanity of our false distinctions, the false distinctions among men, and learn to find our own advancement in search for the advancement of all. We must admit to ourselves that our children's future cannot be built on the misfortune of another's. We must recognize that this short life can neither be ennobled or enriched by hatred or by revenge. Our lives on this planet are too short. The work to be done is too great to let this spirit flourish any longer in this land of ours. Of course, we cannot banish it with a program, nor with a resolution. But we can perhaps remember if only for a time, that those who live with us are our brothers, that they share with us the same short moment of life, that they seek, as do we, nothing but the chance to live out their lives in purpose and in happiness, winning what satisfaction and fulfillment that they can. Surely this bond of common fate, surely this bond of common goals can begin to teach us something. Surely we can learn at the least to look around at those of us, of our fellow men, and surely we can begin to work a little harder to bind up the wounds among us and to become in our hearts brothers and countrymen once again. Tennyson wrote in Ulysses, "That which we are, one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." Thank you very much.